Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Natural Resources, January 22nd, 2007, 8:30 a.m., Hearing Room 174.
Second, 2007. This is our first formal meeting of the subcommittee. We will do a couple of items before we get to the two agencies. We'll start off with Ms. Jordan, who will go through some of the committee details. For the sake of the record, those that are not here are currently excused.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to be working from this notebook that I put in front of your places, and primarily the first sheet in the notebook is just some overview information about how the subcommittee is going to operate, and so I'm going to go through that and then talk a little bit about what's in the notebook for you. On attendance, we would like you to be in the room at 8:30, at the 8:30 a.m. starting time, so we can get started. We have only an hour and a half in this room and a lot of business that needs to be covered, and I'm sure the chair is going to reiterate that when he gets to his remarks. But if you are unable to attend the meeting, please notify our Ways and Means scheduling clerk, who is Lynn Buchanan, and her number is listed on the sheet there for you. Subcommittee rules. Subcommittee is going to use the Joint Committee Ways and Means rules, which are included in your notebook. The subcommittee has three Senate members and five House members. This means that two Senate members and three House members are required to make a quorum and report legislation from the subcommittee to the full committee. Subcommittee members, staff, presenters, and audience members should turn off audible pagers, cell phones, and other electronic devices. The microphones in this room are very sensitive and may pick up side conversations, so be careful about what you're saying. It gets recorded. If a roll call for votes is needed, the roll call will be called by the LFO analyst, not the committee assistant who's sitting at the table. And members need to vacate the hearing room as soon as possible after the conclusion of the meeting so that it can be prepared for the next meeting and so that the assistants can continue working. This is the only place that they have to do their work, and it can be very distracting. Before I go on, I wanted to just take a minute to introduce the other analysts that will be participating, presenting information from the Legislative Fiscal Office so that they can go back to work. And I see Michelle and Don, but I don't see Paul. Can you guys stand up? Michelle and Don each have an agency in natural resources, and they will be sitting at the table and assisting you. And there's Paul. Thanks, Paul. Meeting notice for meetings is required 72 hours ahead for the first public hearing on a bill and 48 hours for subsequent public hearings and work sessions. Bills can be carried over to the next day in cases where the work is not completed with the subcommittee's chair announcement. So if we have a public hearing that's not that hasn't been noticed that we need to carry over, the chair can announce that in subcommittee. We can carry it over to the next meeting date. Daily agendas will be distributed in the subcommittee for that day, so you have a copy of today's agenda at your place. You will have one before every meeting. The weekly agenda will be provided to you by email and at your desk on Thursday, the week prior to the following week's meeting. And there is a copy of that in your packet, so you can see that. Agency budget. A list of the bills assigned to the subcommittee is attached, and that's this green form here. I have also noted on there who the analyst, their phone number, and the budget management division's analyst is for the executive branch. So you have their phone numbers if you have any need for information. Ways and Means co-chair, 2%. Following this green sheet in your packet is information about the 2% reprioritization process that the co-chairs have requested. The requirement is for all agencies and all fund types. We are going to be calculating that off the essential budget level. To achieve our target in the committee, I will be preparing a spreadsheet that shows what our 2% target is. In total for all the natural resources programs, We can take reductions from the governor's recommended budget packages to achieve that target. So that's all technical, but I promise I'll help you with that. And I'm just going to leave that sheet for you to read through. If you have any questions, give me a call, and I'll help you through that. We've also introduced a new process for this budget cycle, and that is that we are going to have an expedited budget hearing process, and I've also included a sheet on what that means for agencies in natural resources. There are three levels of hearings. The first level will be for the expedited would be for agencies with just an essential budget level budget, and maybe no or only minor packages, and those budgets will be heard, and then we will follow that with a work session in the next week probably. The second level of hearings would be budgets that have for agencies with only administrative type packages or a limited number of policy packages, and those would follow the same process. Those agencies would not be subject to the 2% reduction. And then the third level of hearings is our regular budget hearings for agencies that are a little bit more complex. And that sheet is also included in your packet. I've also included a sample of the work session documents that we would be using. It's not real. It's just there will be a memo from each of the analysts for that work session going through the process. And then we have a worksheet that we use that I've also included, so you can get an idea of what it looks like and what kinds of information is included in that when we get to a work session. And let's see, ponies. I've also included a sample pony. We will, when it's assigned to a subcommittee member, we will write the pony for the full committee and for the floor. The tentative order of budget hearings I've listed on this sheet. You have been introduced to the prioritization process. We'll be required to review the agency's priorities, and the subcommittee will have to come up with a priority ranking of their own, which we will publish on our website. The performance measures will be reviewed, and you will need to approve those. We have created a form for that. You are going to receive copies of the budget bill, agency's budget bill, in the hearing the first day, and the binder of the governor's budget will be available in this room, and you are expected to take those back to your offices and bring them to each meeting. You have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't know what a pony is. I know what a pony
is. It's just for speech.
Is your presentation... if you were a full member, there'd be a presentation in the full also.
What does that look like in here?
It's behind the spreadsheets that keep going. There. That's a pony.
Sorry.
It's your first week. That's all right. And don't ask me why they call it a pony. I don't know.
Okay. And I would admonish anyone to read the pony before they actually give it on the floor. and also to be prepared should any questions come up. And in almost all cases, actually with our budgets, in all cases, the analysts will be there on the floor with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. And I am running through this really fast, so if you have questions afterwards, please feel free to come by my office or call me up. Be happy to answer them. Let's see. I've talked about that. I've talked about the subcommittee chair is going to assign a member to carry subcommittee recommendations to the full committee and to the floors of each chamber. The carrier must be a member of the full committee, and we will prepare the pony and be available as the co-chair, the subcommittee chair has just mentioned. It's been protocol that the member from the full committee carry it on the floor, but it can be assigned to someone from from this body to carry it on the floor. I don't think that's a house rule. I think that's just protocol. In fact, we've done it before. So.
Yeah.
Budget notes may be included in the budget report if essential to clarify or expand on administrative requirements directly related to the budget. And I'm going to stress that proposed budget notes must be channeled through the subcommittee chair and must be jointly approved by the co-chairs. If one doesn't approve it, then it won't be included in the budget. Other work that the subcommittee is going to be dealing with are budget-related fee bills, federal grant application requests, agency reports, and substantive legislation with fiscal impact as assigned by the co-chair. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the federal grant requests. Those are going to be treated similar to an emergency board action. The agency will send a letter through the Department of Administrative Services to the co-chairs requesting permission to apply for a grant. We'll write a short analysis of the grant request. It'll be scheduled under the scheduling guidelines for subcommittee review. The subcommittee will recommend whether to approve applying for that grant, and then we will take that to the full committee. If the full committee doesn't meet before the application deadline, subcommittee approval will be deemed permission for the agency to go ahead and apply, and the full committee should for some reason disagree, they will have to pull it back that so the agency can meet their deadline. And the other information that I've included in your notebook is just a copy of the LFO analysis for each agency that will be included in the Natural Resources Subcommittee work. And one last thing I just want to quickly go over, and that is the program area. There's a slide presentation at the end of that first section. This information was not presented to the full Ways and Means Committee, but it's just to give you some perspective of how natural resources sits in the whole statewide perspective of budgets. And I'm not going to go through each slide. I'll leave that to you to do for leisure.
I have a question for Susan.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the slide that shows the $1.549 million budget. Is that just the general fund portion, or does that include federal grants and fees as well?
That's everything.
Everything. Thank you.
Yes, that's it.
Thank you, Ms. Jordan. I just had a couple of comments about how the committee will operate. Ms. Jordan has given a lot of those, but I'll just go through a few things. One of the things is that this committee has a considerable number of budgets. And some of those budgets we will have as little, there's only one of those, but we will have as little as one day to actually go through that budget. A long consideration for a budget will be 4 days before this committee. It'll be a slightly different process that we had in the past in one very clear way, and that is in the last session we went through three different phases, which meant that we had a long time between the first phase and the final phase of making decisions to resolve issues. We won't really have that long of a period of time this time, although I can see a lot of those issues being addressed and resolved even before the budget actually comes before the committee. In regard to budgets coming before the committee, as soon as we get full clearance on it, I think we already have that, but we'll try to get you actually a full committee schedule in terms of when the budgets will be coming to this committee. I don't know if the co-chairs have given final approval for that yet.
They haven't.
They're always very punctual in terms of dealing with issues.
But I did put in a list of the general order in this sheet of when the budgets would be coming up. It's very tentative and subject to change at any minute, so it's difficult to keep that up to date.
Yeah. I just wanted to give you some idea that some of the budgets that you have a lot of interest in might be coming up 2 weeks from now, and Ms. Jordan's put them in sort of a probably their logical order that they may come before the committee. Some of them we won't be considering for another month and a half or more. Some of the other issues before the committee, I would hope that everyone would, when we get to the actual consideration of the budgets, which will be starting next week, that you read the LFO analysis for that budget before coming here, and that you actually obtain, they should be available a week in advance, the agency's folders for their budgets in terms of their information. There's another issue that I think is important to discuss just to mention briefly. This is a Ways and Means Subcommittee. It is not a natural resources or an environment policy committee. We are here to basically to look at the budget, determine whether the dollars are well spent, to determine whether the direction in state law and other areas are being carried out and to what degree they are being carried out. We will eventually venture into policy because sometimes we will have issues where there are not enough resources to do everything that the state has asked an agency to do. But this is probably not the venue to debate the bill that you'll have before the House Environment or Natural Resources Committee or the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. This is a budget committee, not a policy committee. Or to debate a bill that you voted on a failing side in a previous session, that you think that the policy should be changed. We actually determine budgets. It's up to other people to determine policy. Ms. Jordan has already mentioned calling in if you're going to be late. One of the things, and many of you have served on Ways and Means subcommittees, but one of the things I'd like to stress is that we will not have that many votes in this committee. I don't know what the total number of votes will be, but I would guess it will be less than 30 in total. I don't know exactly how many fee bills we have. We have a few major fee bills, but very few votes actually occur in subcommittee because we really do not have that many items before us. The other thing is I would hope that people would develop sort of a standard for when they would support a bill or oppose a bill. And I hope that standard wouldn't be that you agreed with 99% of what was in the bill, because if that's your standard, you probably won't ever vote for a budget bill in a Ways and Means subcommittee, because if you get two-thirds of what you think should be in the bill, I think you're doing pretty well in a subcommittee. If there is an issue that we had an issue with in the last session, And I very much believe that each individual member's vote belongs to them and belongs to their constituents. But if you vote yes in the subcommittee, and if you're a full member and you vote yes there, or if you're not a full member and you voted yes in the subcommittee, I expect to hear, and the co-chairs expect to hear, long before the bill actually gets to a vote on the floor, that for some reason you want to change your vote. Because it looks very bad when a bill comes out of subcommittee with a very strong vote, not of the full, and then gets to the floor, and there are members that are switching their vote from the full or from the subcommittee. That's because it's very rare for budget bills to die on the floor or to have to be sent back. So when we send a bill out of the subcommittee that's on a fairly strong vote, the co-chairs expect that those people are going to be voting for the bill when it gets to their respective floors. Doesn't mean that if you voted no, you can't vote yes, to put it bluntly, but we would like to hear, at least before the bill gets to the floor, that for some reason you're going to change your vote. That's about it. I will probably follow what I always appear to be the golden rule, is to treat everyone in this process as I would like to be treated, and I would hope you would follow the same. So that I think we will have a very cordial period for this committee. I will keep it relatively formal, but I don't expect any witnesses before this committee, whether they're staff or general public or LFO staff, to be treated with anything less than the highest respect for coming before this process. With that, we will get started here. I don't know if we need to really do introductions because everybody knows everybody here.
Except the guy that didn't know what a pony was.
Well, that's actually
I thought it was so bad enough.
The guy who happens to represent the capital in your district?
Not technically.
No.
A block.
Representative, I didn't know what a pony was either. I just know they bring up a sheet of paper. I didn't realize they call it a pony. I guess that's what the pony is. Isn't it?
Call it a thoroughbred.
Don't tell them what a horse is.
Well, we will go ahead and get started. I guess we will have about 30 minutes on each of these, and then a few minutes for questions. I'd ask that you hold your questions to the end of the presentation, That will not be the process probably once we get into the budgets, because that'll be a more deliberative process. But I guess the first item before us is an old friend, or maybe an old friend.
Department really of old.
He's old.
Yeah. The Department of Land Conservation and Development. Mr. Shetterly, if you want to bring up anyone with you. Ms. Jordan, do you have some beginning comments that you'd like to go through?
I do not.
You do not. Okay, then, Mr. Shetterly, it's all up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I understand we are your first agency to meet and give overview, so I thank you for that opportunity. I hope that we will provide what you are after in this. I've laid out a fairly bullet point type of presentation. I intend to keep my comments not strictly to the written testimony, but to follow those along generally with a general overview of the department and program to give you some context for your future budget discussions. But again, keeping with what I understand to be the instructions from the co-chairs and LFO staff, we will not be addressing budget per se unless you raise some particular questions for me to address. With that, Representative Clem, don't feel bad about the pony. I do remember in the 1999 session there was a member of the House Judiciary Committee who asked at one early meeting who misdemeanor was. And it's serious. That was an honest question. No, I'm serious. It actually
is. That's why we have sworn testimony in these hearings.
It's on tape. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in giving you an overview of the department, I think it would be helpful to begin with about a two-minute history of the program itself, because, of course, the department is inextricably connected with the statewide land use planning program. And I am sorry, I've violated one rule already by failing to introduce myself at the beginning, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. But really that is important to understand the connection between the program and the department, because they are so inextricably connected. The program in its modern iteration began in 1973 with the adoption of Senate Bill 100. And Senate Bill 100 was the statutory creation of a statewide land use planning program, and it did two fundamental things, really. It created the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and under that, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. But then it also created a set of statewide standards with a directive to local governments to implement comprehensive plans that then would be in keeping with the state standards for a land use planning program. That initial directive from the legislature in Senate Bill 100 was to LCDCs to adopt statewide land use planning goals to guide the implementation of those comprehensive plans by local governments, and also, again, the department to support that work. So the sense was that the state was going to create a framework for a land use planning program through state statute by administrative rule authority given to LCDC, including the adoption of statewide planning goals. And then local governments were going to implement their own comprehensive plans that were consistent with the statewide directives. And the function and purpose of the department was in large part to help make those objectives reality, so that the local governments implementing the statewide planning program would have technical assistance and grant resources through the department and through the commission to accomplish the adoption of their local comprehensive plans. And that is really a description in large respect of the program and the department. Even today, we see our function largely as providing technical assistance to local governments to help them ensure compliance with the statewide planning goals. We also provide grant resources to local governments to help them implement through their own budgets the requirements of what the state expects of them to do. Now, in the beginning, it was expected that the adoption of comprehensive plans by all 36 counties and 240 cities, I think, at the time, would take about a year or two. And it was anticipated that'd be a fairly fast-track process. As we know, history didn't play out quite so cleanly as that, and I think my county, if I'm my recollection is correct, Polk County may have been the last county to finish the process of adopting its comprehensive plan and getting it acknowledged by LCDC as consistent with the state program. And I believe after a couple of trips up to the appellate courts, that was finished in 1989. But nevertheless, through that process, and it was an iterative process, I think, on the part of both the state and local governments, we did accomplish the goal of having comprehensive plans adopted by each of the cities and counties in the state, and those comprehensive plans were acknowledged by LCDC as being consistent with state law. That acknowledgement is important because then that basically gives the local government the authority to fully implement its local decisions based on its comprehensive plan, because that comprehensive plan has been found consistent with state law. As we moved through the adoption of comprehensive plans by local governments was a key element of the beginning of the program. As we moved through the adoption of comprehensive plans, and more cities and counties got their plans acknowledged as being consistent with state law, there was a dawning realization that while the documents were finished, time and other reality, time and real life, kept moving on, and over time these comprehensive plans would become out of date. And not current in terms of meeting the needs and demands of the local communities. And so there was born the notion of periodic review, that periodically cities and counties should recycle their comprehensive plans back through a planning process to make sure that they are made current, not only to meet new requirements of state law, but also to make sure that they are current to meet the demands of the market and other demands in their communities. And so responsibility then of the department was extended beyond just the to assist in local governments adopting comprehensive plans and assisting them through periodic review to make sure that those plans were kept up to date. And that also remains a function of our department today, participating with local governments in periodic review, although after last session, the number of local governments that are actually subject to periodic review has been substantially reduced. That gets us then to, and I should also mention that in addition to the state statutes that are encompassed largely within Chapter 197 and Chapter 215 of the statutes, the framework of the program is embodied in the 19 statewide planning goals, and the administrative rules were adopted have been adopted on an ongoing basis by LCDC to implement both the statutes and the goals. The mission statement of the department is expressed in the handout that you have before you to support all of our partners in creating and implementing comprehensive plans that reflect and balance statewide planning goals, the vision of citizens, and the interest of local, state, and federal and tribal governments. That really does capture, I think, what I described in my opening testimony to you. The department works under the overview of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. That's LCDC. It consists of 7 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And they, by statute, represent various interests and geographical scope of the state. Counties and cities are represented, as well as the development interests. That membership, again, is prescribed by statute, appointed by the governor, and confirmed by the Senate. LCDC has really 3 main functions. One is the administrative overview of the department. They are our boss. They also review our budgets. LCDC has its own budget and management subcommittee that reviews budget and fiscal administration of the department. They are the department's and the state's policy and rulemaking body when it comes to land use, and they are the adjudicatory body of issues that come before the department. The agenda of the LCDC meeting this week expresses a couple of those functions. And I think pretty clearly in terms of policy and rulemaking, we have on the agenda this week when LCDC comes to town adoption of administrative rules governing the filing of Measure 37 claims out in the counties. They have the authority to adopt rules that are binding on cities, counties in the ambit of the program that we administer. As far as their role in adjudicatory function, we have an appeal of a urban growth boundary decision where we approved an urban growth boundary amendment, an expansion of the city of Woodburn. That's been appealed by various interests, and LCDC will be sitting in an adjudicatory function this week to hear the appeals of that urban growth boundary decision. LCDC also hears appeals of periodic review decisions out in local governments, but it should be clear to the committee, and I think it will be as we get into this, that LCDC is not the Land Use Board of Appeals. Most appeals in the state of land use decisions go to the Land Use Board of Appeals, not to LCDC. We review primarily decisions around periodic review and urban growth boundary amendments on which we have made determinations. LCDC also, as I mentioned, adopted the statewide planning goals in the beginning, and we continue to amend those from time to time with the statutory authority to do that. LCDC has advisory committees created by statute. One is the Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee that advises the commission on matters relative to citizen involvement, both before the commission and also before local governments around the state. And we have the Local Officials Advisory Committee, which consists of, as the name suggests, elected officials from cities and counties to also advise the commission in the adoption of rules and policy in particular. The function of the department, as I touched on, and I'll try and crystallize it once more, really we see it as being largely two functions.
different programs that have grown grant funds and availability. And our focus is on programs that provide climate assistance to social zones in communities that are not otherwise shared with the city. We have some of that grant program in the social general technical assistance to the same kind of funding, but the federal government.
not only the history of the program, but also some of the work that we have done in a couple of years to keep the program moving forward, even as we have labored under the provision of services in the review of ballot measure 37 claims and the litigation that flows from that. I think we've done a commendable job in moving that land use planning program forward. We have briefly amended Goal 11 with respect to provision of sewer services in rural to rural development. We have adopted economic development amendments to our economic development rules to better assist local governments in focusing their efforts in economic development planning. And we also have provided a Goal 9 guidebook to local governments that again tells them how they can better get involved in the economic development planning. The LeGrand office is one of our newest field office. We're pleased to have opened that in the last biennium. We provide a quarterly newsletter for local governments that gets good reports. We do it by website with a constant update then of developments in the planning world. We have adopted rules that streamline and assist the standards for farm stands and destination resorts, that latter being in response to legislation in the 2005 legislative session. I was pleased that in our first customer service survey, more than three out of four areas in which we were surveyed, we were rated between good and excellent by our constituents, which I think to be a good benchmark for measuring our service and a place from which we hope we can still show some improvement, but again, a very good place to begin. We've adopted rules that clarify and amend the UGB amendment process. I think a mystery for local governments from the dawn of time on how to amend a UGB and do it with some comfort level that they're not going to be appealed on any number of decision points. So providing rulemaking, we've clarified that UGB process and streamlined it as well. We've also amended rules regarding the transportation planning rule, and that was done in conjunction with ODOT. We did something significant, and I think for which I'm very proud in Bend. We co-sponsored a full-day conference last October in co-sponsorship with the Oregon Realtors Association, the National Realtors Association, the Central Oregon Realtors Association, and the ODOT and the Transportation Growth Management Program, all about our urban development program and how our land use program supports planning that actually makes sense in the market and that developers and realtors can seize on to better serve their constituents. We also provide Planners Network meetings across the state. Next week we will be in LeGrand meeting with Eastern Oregon planners, again for the purpose of bringing them up to date on developments in the planning program. And I personally spend a good part of my time on the road traveling statewide. And in our biennial report, there is a map that actually shows the places where I have been in the past 18 months. I think it is important to be visible around the state and to present a face to the department and the program and not just be seen as making edicts and sending directives from the state capitol. So we make it a point to try and be visible on a consistent basis across the state. Challenges ahead, as you can imagine, and you probably know from reading the paper, we have a huge challenge with ballot measure 37. It's been an ongoing challenge to meet the 180-day deadline for determining claims under the ballot measure. That deadline, challenge was exacerbated by the level of claims that we saw in the last 4 weeks before the December 4 change in filing process. I can tell you right now that we will need relief in some form or another from the legislature in order to meet that 180-day timeline in order to get the claim decisions made under current law. We are not equipped to deal with the volume of about 3,700 claims that came in the last 4.5-5 weeks of the measure based on current staffing. And I can tell you that is not a challenge that is unique to the state. The counties are facing the same risks and challenges as well because every one of the claims that we have almost every one of the claims that we have has a counterpart claim in the counties. And while each county's gross numbers may be smaller than ours, their resources to deal with those are also substantially less. And so that will be a challenge for us as we, and I say us together, as we work through this session. Also challenges ahead, while I mentioned that periodic review is required for fewer jurisdictions than in the past, we do have, I think it is 13 jurisdictions in Metro alone that will be going into periodic review starting in July. That's a labor-intensive effort not only for local governments but for us as well. And so that represents a challenge that we will be looking ahead to in the coming biennium. Briefly on our legislative concepts, we have two bills that are of similar nature relating to providing greater flexibility to local governments in developing industrial reserves and planning for affordable housing. Those concepts authorize rulemaking to the department and to the Land Conservation and Development Commission make more flexible planning at the local level for industrial development and affordable housing. And we have an issue in front of the Judiciary Committee on the standard of review for administrative rules and goals, but that's fairly arcane, and I'll be glad to answer any questions about that, but won't explain it otherwise. Mr. Chair, that's a lot to say in a small amount of time. I hope I've at least provided some context. I think what I would, probably in the bigger picture, again, what I would go back to say is that Senate Bill 100 and legislative support for the planning program since then has captured a vision of the state that really is focused on efficient use of land for development inside urban growth areas, efficient in terms of space, also efficient in terms of cost of providing services, and its counterpart to that being a lesser level of development in farm and forest lands to maintain those as primarily available for farming and forest-related activities. That's the planning program in a nutshell. Our efforts to support that in terms of technical assistance to local governments, grant assistance to local governments, and to support the work of the Commission in its ongoing policy and rulemaking. I don't think I have any more. I know you've got another budget before you, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you have at this time.
We have about 4 or 5 minutes for questions, just for the record so that people know. Could the Department of Administrative Services budget management analyst identify themselves for the...
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. I'm Satish Upadhyaya. I'm the budget analyst with the Department of Administrative Services.
He's been around a long time, and I still cannot pronounce his name.
But, I can't pronounce my last name either, so.
But I thought it's important for you to, every time there's someone here, there will be here someone from the Department of Administrative Services and Budget Management. So.
Hey, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think I have my Deputy Director, Cora Parker, is with us here today, as well as Bob Rindy, our policy specialist from the department. You'll be seeing both of them probably during the session as well.
Any questions for Mr. Shedwick? Representative Clinton.
And I'll thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try and do the quick ones and then maybe tell which ones I'd like to have further conversation, okay, maybe in my office or somewhere else, so I don't take the committee time. In terms of getting a list of who actually is on the commission, is that available on the website?
It is available on the website. I think they're in the biennial report as well, but they're certainly available on the website. They are on the report. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Two, this is going to be, I think, an office visit, so I'll just explain the general topic, which is Senator Vakian probably already knows all the answers to this, but this deals with...
Probably.
urbanization that occurs within an urban growth boundary already, say 20, 30 years ago, that is still unannexed or unincorporated. And I'd like to talk about how goals 15 and 11 play into it's already urbanized, but it's within an urban growth boundary, not a city, but part of the county, you know, sort of what the theories are behind that, because I get told what the theories are by local government all the time, and I would like to have the state perspective. Question 2.5. Does the director appointed by the governor, or is it the commission has higher fire authority?
Thank you. That's a good question, Mr. Chair. Representative Clem, the director, is appointed by the commission.
Okay.
And the commission, then, of course, appointed by the governor.
Okay. And I think that sort of gets to my other question. I was chair of a commission that has a student assistance commission, similar relationship, some quasi-policy making things delegated by statute, hire fire technically, governor obviously cares a lot about who the person is.
There is a symbiotic relationship.
Gotcha. And then I would like to, if it's not been established for my other assignment, that at least one other member on this committee shares with the new Special Joint Committee on Land Use Fairness, understand the price tag to your agency of those 12 positions solely devoted to Measure 37, plus the additional pieces of other, you know, to the greatest extent possible, other folks' time. How much is Measure 37 really costing to process the state in the last year?
Do you want the short answer to that?
It could be later. If
you know. Yeah, it's 16 positions. Thank you. 16. Mr. Chair, we'll get that information to you. I think the budget package that we have right now for Measure 37 is $4.5 million. I will say that budget was crafted before the 3,700 claims that came in the last 5 weeks before December 4. So I think we're all in the process of discovering what that number is going to be.
The $4.5 million
increase.
And if I may also clarify, that is for the positions devoted exclusively to ballot measure 37. It's hard to quantify the cost when you're talking about the time that other positions spend. Those positions already exist. They're in the budget. Really, what you're, the impact there is work that's not getting done in the way of providing technical assistance or other things that they would be doing that are more pertinent to their regular positions involving urban growth boundary amendments, periodic review, economic development planning. Those are the things that they would be doing. So you won't see those measured in actual dollars, but those are a cost in the sense that that's work that's not being done by staff and has to be redirected from those kinds of functions to assisting ballot measure 37.
Mr. Chair, if I may, that also doesn't include the cost for the Department of Administrative Services to process those claims. They're the initial clearinghouse for them. It does, however, include the Attorney General costs because the agency has to pay those.
Good point.
Mr. Chair, and I'm basically done. Representative Burley's shown me two times when I could have just read the material. Lesson learned on that point. Just if at some point we start to, you know, be able to keep a running price tag, you know, the next couple of weeks if analysis evolves of the cost of Measure 37, including then DAS and BAM and Attorney General and the new 3,700 claims, it would be helpful for additional deliberations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, we are engaged in that even as we speak. That's going to be a key budget issue for us.
Yes. Burley, then Representative Dingfelter, then Representative Garrard, and you all have about 1 minute each. So,
be very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, did I understand you then to say that you probably will be increasing the request for funds for to deal with the Measure 37 over what's currently in the?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, it really depends. If we maintain at a current staffing level, that is what we're looking for in the budget, we figure it would be about 18 months to get through that bucket of claims that came in during the last 5 weeks. That wouldn't require so much an increase in budget as it would, and there's a hydraulic there. There's an extension of time within which to process the claims. As you shorten that time, then there's going to be, in that hydraulic, an increase in the need for staffing. I will tell you, counties have expressed concern, and I think it's not a serious concern, that somehow the state would solve this problem by bringing in all sorts of staff and providing all sorts of funding to solve our problem so that we can get all these claims out in 180 days. Because, of course, they don't have that option with their limited resources. I don't think we have the capacity in reality even to do that. So, to me, it's going to be somehow meeting a balance in that hydraulic between an extension of time and then staffing needs.
Just had a very quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding on, they don't have page numbers, but it's page 3 of the analyst report list that says the department recently established the Measure 37 Claims Division, and it lists that you currently have the 16 FTEs. So my question was, that, if I recall, was not anticipated in the governor's budget last time. Is that correct?
There, Representative, Senator, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, there was a Measure 37 component built into the 05-07 budget. That has increased over as the biennium has gone on. I think we were in June, as I recall. We were back in June for an increase in there. It was anticipated that we would need to come back during the biennium. And so it was provided for in the budget to the extent that we have the staffing now.
So it was the 16 FTE? Or what I'm trying to figure out is did you shift staff from other divisions, basically, for the 16 FTE, or all of those FTE anticipated in last biennium's budget?
You were before the E-Board, weren't you?
Yeah, I'll do my best to answer this, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and Susie can help me if she wants to, please. I'm trying to relive now the biennium. We came out of the session with a certain assumption of funding needs. We knew that we were undershooting what that need was going to be, but we weren't sure how much. And so there was authority reserved to come back to E-Board, which we did in June, to get our current level of staffing. And as far as other staff goes, again, though they're not the non Measure 37 staff that are doing Measure 37 work really aren't. You won't see them. You won't see the impact of that in the budget. As I mentioned, that's really more a matter of shifting duties as opposed to shifting costs. I don't know, Susie, is there a better way to describe that?
You did some triage work right up front in order to get started on the Measure 37 claims using existing staff and pulling in whoever you could get to.
That's a good point, a good clarification. I would say that to the our non-Measure 37 staff has had to devote less of its time as we have brought dedicated Measure 37 staff on. We have put everyone on notice that that may be shifting back, at least until we get some legislative relief, because right now we're still functioning under a 180-day timeline for all those claims. I will tell you we're not going to meet it, but we're not pretending that it doesn't exist. And so we're asking for more involvement in our non-Measure 37 staff even as we speak. So we have the dedicated staff. Everybody else kind of fills in as needed to keep the process moving as best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, we've become all too close over since your appointment.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Grider, we're going to become closer even this session. I can see it.
Wonderful. I really look forward to that. Lane, you spoke of the extension of time.
Yes.
Both from your agency and for the counties. What is an adequate, in your opinion, an adequate extension of time, and is there a large cost involved with that extension?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, again, I'll give you as best I can. These are preliminary, but what we have calculated at this point would be that without increasing the request that we have made for in the current budget for staffing for dedicated to Measure 37 and litigation expense, although that's still kind of a wild card since we don't control that, that's a demand-driven cost with a number of claims that get filed. And we do get sued both by disappointed claimants and it comes at us from both ways, no matter how we decide the claims. If you were to extend the time, we calculate that based on current staffing levels, it would take 18 months to get the claims out the door starting at about the end of October. So claims coming in beginning in the latter part of October, if we just moved those through at a high rate that we are currently capable of doing under current staffing requirements, it would still be 18 months before we get out. That would be largely no budget impact, except, again, on the litigation side. Getting back to Representative Burley's earlier question, as you shorten up that time frame, let's say we don't get 18 months, let's say we get a year, that's going to drive at least some need for more staffing in order to get the claims out the door.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shetterly. We have to move on to the Division of State Lands. I believe you would be... You would say this, that your staff will be available to any committee member that has a question.
You know we will. Well, thank you, and we'll follow up, particularly with Representative Flynn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We will move now to the Department of State Lands. Louise Soliday. Is that
Good morning.
Please begin.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Soliday. You'll have about 20 minutes, and then we'll go to questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. What I want to do today is talk about a little bit about our agency, a little bit about our divisions and programs, some of our key changes that were made during this biennium, and some issues that you'll be hearing about as we move into our fuller discussion of our budget in a couple of weeks. First of all, the mission of the Department of State Lands is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property estates, and the Common School Fund. We have a set of 8 goals, and you have attached in your little packet on the blue sheet our goal statements. Those are the goals that are included in our strategic plan that cover all of our major program areas, as well as customer service and administration, and 2 programs that are part of the Department of State Lands, the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve and the Oregon Natural Heritage Program. The Department of State Lands is one of the oldest agencies in state government. It was created back in 1878 for the purpose of managing what are called common school funds.
As you shorten up that time frame, let's say we don't get 18 months, let's say we get a year, that's going to drive at least some need for more staffing in order to get the claims out the door.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shetterly. We have to move on to the Division of State Lands. I believe you would be... You would say this, that your staff will be available to any committee member that has a question.
You know we will. Well, thank you, and we'll follow up, particularly with Representative Flynn. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We will move now to the Department of State Lands. Louise Soliday.
Good morning.
Please begin. Ms. Soliday. You'll have about 20 minutes, and then we'll go to questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. What I want to do today is talk about a little bit about our agency, a little bit about our divisions and programs, some of our key changes that were made during this biennium, and some issues that you'll be hearing about as we move into our fuller discussion of our budget in a couple of weeks. First of all, the mission of the Department of State Lands is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property estates, and the Common School Fund. We have a set of 8 goals, and you have attached in your little packet on the blue sheet our goal statements. Those are the goals that are included in our strategic plan that cover all of our major program areas, as well as customer service and administration, and 2 programs that are part of the Department of State Lands, the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve and the Oregon Natural Heritage Program. The Department of State Lands is one of the oldest agencies in state government. It was created back in 1878 for the purpose of managing what are called Common School Fund trust lands, or our constitutional lands, which were granted to the state at statehood in order to finance a system of public education. The state received the 16th and the 36th section of every township in the state of Oregon in order to create a funding source to initiate a public education system. We have since been granted other lands, including submerged and submersible lands, swamp lands, and other lands over time that have become part of the real estate portfolio that is part of the Common School Fund that the Department of State Lands manages. Our policy making board is the State Land Board. It consists of the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer, so three statewide elected officials, and they are responsible for hiring and firing the director. So I report directly to the State Land Board. We have several major responsibilities within the department. First and foremost is increasing revenues over time to the Common School Fund in order to increase distributions to the 198 K-12 school districts around the state. We make those distributions twice a year based on the increase in the balance of the Common School Fund at the end of each calendar year. We have four major programs within the department. First is managing the real estate portfolio, the lands that are part of the Common School Fund, in an attempt to raise revenue into the Common School Fund. We have a regulatory function with regard to removal fill activities in waters of the state and wetlands of the state. We also manage wetland conservation and mitigation programs under a statute that was passed back in 1989. We also are responsible for administering what are called escheated estates, and those are estates where an individual dies and they have no will and no known heirs. And the estates program is responsible for managing the value of those estates, attempting to locate rightful heirs. If we're unsuccessful in finding those heirs over a 10-year period of time, that money is escheated to the Common School Fund permanently and is available for distribution. And we also have what's called the Unclaimed Property Program. Those are properties in both intangibles and tangibles that are dormant for a period of time, bank accounts, insurance policies, stocks and bonds. There's a whole variety of assets that are turned over to the state after a period of dormancy, and the responsibility of the state is to attempt to locate the rightful owner of those properties. That property is held in trust in perpetuity. In the event that a rightful owner does show up to claim it, the interest on those properties, that revenue that's held in trust, do accrue to the Common School Fund and are part of the distributions that go out to school districts. In addition to those responsibilities, we also have these two smaller programs, the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve, which was the first reserve put into this federal program. There are 27 other programs around the country that are estuarine research reserves. Their responsibility in the case of South Slough is to do research, education, and stewardship related to estuarine health and trends, collect trends data, and hopefully that information is useful not just to South Slough Estuary, but all estuaries on the Oregon coast and the West Coast. And then we finally have what's called the Oregon Heritage Natural Heritage Program, which has been around for a little over 25 years, and that's a program where certain lands are designated as natural heritage lands, and they are put into the program voluntarily by various landowners, and they are used to provide a higher level of protection because they contain significant ecological resources of one sort or another. We have our major funding source for the Department of State Lands, our Common School Fund revenues. So we pay our expenses as we're generating those revenues out of the Common School Fund revenues. We also have several federal grants, several of those for the South Slough Reserve, but we also have a couple of federal grants that fund some staff in our Wetlands and Waterways Division. We get a small amount of general fund, mainly to support our economic revitalization team staff person, and a tiny bit of general fund that helps to support the Natural Heritage Program Advisory Council. And then we get a little bit of other grant funds, which generally come from other state agencies that we work in partnership with. Our staffing, we have 99 FTE at the moment. About 20% of those are limited duration positions, and they're limited duration for one of two reasons. Generally, they're on what we call soft money, that is grant funds that have a limited duration to them, or we have a set of limited duration positions which we initially requested as permanent. The legislature approved them as limited duration to make sure that we were going to need them on a consistent basis, and we'll be talking with you about some of those during the next phase of the budget process. We have three offices in the state. Our main office is in Salem. It's actually, we own our own office building. Unlike most of the state office buildings, it is an asset of the Common School Fund, and it's the way we generate revenue by charging rent to the other agencies who we share that building with. And then we have an office in Charleston where our South SLU staff is located and one of our wetland staff. And then we have an office location in Bend where our Eastern Region staff, both for the Land Management Division and our Wetlands and Waterways Division, reside. We have, I've laid out for you the divisions on the overall outline. The director's office, very small office of four staff. The human resources functions and the communications functions are in my office. We have a finance and administration division, which provides the centralized services, both the fiscal services and the information system services for the agency, and also includes both the estates and the unclaimed property programs. Our land management division, which has an eastern section, a western section, and an asset management section, is responsible for managing all of our trust and non-trust land, our submerged and submersible lands, and mineral rights that we hold both on our lands as well as on other state agency lands. And we make those lands available for lease and uses, rents, rental around the state. We also get royalties from various activities that occur on those lands. Our Wetlands and Waterways Conservation Division is where our removal fill permitting activities and our wetlands conservation and mitigation activities occur, and it's also where our economic revitalization team staff person resides. A lot of the work that he is involved in is directly related to our removal fill permitting program and helping local governments get through that process and also to identify opportunities for wetland mitigation where those mitigation needs exist in order to develop industrial and commercial opportunities within local communities. I've talked about South SLU and the Heritage Program, which are separate program units within our budget. We made a couple of major changes during the 05-07 biennium. We did go through a major agency reorganization. Previously, we had our policy and planning function separate from our field operations function. What we've decided to do is really separate our land management functions from our regulatory functions and put the planning and policy folks with the people who actually are doing the work out in the field in each of those divisions. And so we went through a major reorganization that was implemented in September of 2005, and it was discussed with the 2005 legislature. And I think from our perspective, it is working as intended. It's allowing us to also better track our activities to our key performance measures that we have and our budget, our revenues and our expenses. So starting with this next biennium, we will have everything lined up with our divisions, with our various land management and regulatory activities that we have within the department. And then secondly, the land board in October of last year adopted a new 10-year asset management plan. That is the plan that drives how we manage our real estate portfolio. We have about 2.3 million acres of land that we manage and another 2.1 million acres of mineral rights that we manage for other state agencies. So we have a significant real estate portfolio. It's valued between about $650 million and $850 million. The asset management plan has some key themes to it. One is the plan indicates that we want to retain some of our core assets that we have, and that includes the Elliott State Forest and our big blocks of rangeland that we have out in southeast Oregon, along with some of our other lands. It also calls for us to begin to acquire additional lands with it that provide enhanced revenue opportunities. As I like to describe it, it sort of shifts us to a more aggressive position with our real estate portfolio, looking at opportunities to pick up more industrial, commercial, residential development lands and less of the agriculture rangeland and forestry lands that have been traditionally part of the Common School Fund. We've also identified a number of acres of isolated non-revenue producing lands that we are probably going to offer for sale over the next 5 to 10 years. There's about 12,000 acres of rangelands and agricultural lands, and about another 12,000 acres or so of forest lands scattered around the state, not producing a lot of revenue, having some expenses associated with them. We believe those are better to get back on the tax rolls out of the Common School Fund, use those resources then to invest in lands that are going to produce more revenue for the Common School Fund over the long term. And there are a number of reclassifications of lands within the new asset management plan to reflect either their current use or what we hope to see as their future use over time. The land classification system that we use is one that we've been talking with the Western States Land Commissioners Association about adopting west-wide so that we are all reporting using the same classification system. And I think the Western States Land Commissioners Association is on a path to actually adopt the land classification that we initiated here in Oregon to be used by all of the Western states so that we have good comparative data coming from all the Western states on revenues and expenses for those lands. We have a number of outstanding issues within the department. We do have this brand new asset management plan, so implementation of that plan, making sure that we are beginning to shift to this more aggressive posture with our real estate portfolio. The Portland Harbor Superfund site cleanup, we are involved both from a proprietary stand because we are the owner of the submerged and submersible lands within Portland Harbor and have had lessees there over many, many years, some of whom may have contributed to the problems that exist in the Superfund site today. And we also have a regulatory responsibility because we do regulate removal fill activities, and we expect that there will be quite a bit of permitting or activities associated with various remedies that will be implemented as the cleanup of the harbor begins. The timeline for that is shifting, as most Superfund cleanup timelines do. The goal was to have a record of decision by 2008. I would expect that that deadline is probably not going to be met, given that they are still trying to collect additional information and data. We'll be bringing a package to you to fund our staff needs related to that. We're also working and have been working for several years on development of an Elliott State Forest, Forest Management Plan, and Habitat Conservation Plan. Our goal is to actually have a Habitat Conservation Plan in place by early 2008. This has been a many-year effort, and hopefully we're coming towards the end of that. From the land board's perspective and the department's perspective, it is necessary for us to be able to have long-term business certainty in terms of harvest, sustainable harvest level out of the Elliott State Forest. Right now, we are managing under a habitat conservation plan for owls only and a take avoidance strategy for marbled murrelets. That take avoidance strategy for marbled murrelets has resulted in reduced harvest levels below what we had expected to occur. And for so we are working very hard to get a habitat, a 60-year habitat conservation plan in place for owls, murrelets, and other at-risk species in the forest. New CARISA, the emergency board, we reached a settlement agreement back in the late spring of 2006. The emergency board in September gave us limitation for the removal. We had hoped that the removal would take place this summer. We got caught in our own process in terms of negotiating with our removal contractor. We also have several permits that we'll need to get in place for that removal, so we have delayed the actual removal operation to 2008, but it's still on schedule to occur. Inland land selections, when we got our lands back at statehood, Sections 16 and 36 of each township, well, there were some places where those had already been settled by others, and so the state was supposed to receive land in lieu of Sections 16 and 36. We never got all of our lands. We ended up going to court against the BLM in the late 1980s, and in the early 1990s were successful with that litigation. The BLM was directed to turn over an additional 5,202 acres to the state of Oregon. We have received some of those lands but are still owed about 3,400 acres of land. My goal since coming to the department last year is that by the sesquicentennial in 2009, we will actually get all the lands we were due at statehood. And we are working hard on those. We have selected lands mostly in central Oregon in areas where we think there is good opportunity for industrial, commercial, and residential development, both in the short term and the long term, to complete that process. We have been working on some streamlining and efficiency efforts both in the permitting area and in our e-commerce areas. We did attempt a streamlining process to try and roll into the state removal fill process the federal authorizations for the same activity, the core permit, the ESA Endangered Species Act consultations that are done by the services, Coastal Zone Management Authorization 401 certification, in what was called the State Programmatic General Permit. It was we started it in January of last year. We cried uncle in September and asked the Corps to suspend that effort because it was not delivering the streamlined services that it was intended to deliver. And so we are back to the drawing board trying to redesign that streamlining effort. We also have been working with several state agencies to try and streamline state permitting through the removal fill program, and you'll hear more about that during our budget discussion in a couple of weeks. And then finally, our unclaimed property program, there is both legislation and budget packages in that would move the unclaimed property program from the Department of State Lands to the Office of the State Treasurer. In most states, it is located in the Office of the State Treasurer. If you were out there trying to figure out where your unclaimed property was, the Department of State Lands is probably not the first place you would think to call. There is, as I said, both legislation and budget packages that would shift that program from our department to the Office of the State Treasurer. In fact, the subsidence bill will be up tomorrow morning in the Senate Education Committee. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Saladin. Just for the record, could the Administrative Services and Budget Management Analyst identify themselves?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson. I'm the Budget Management Analyst assigned to the Department of State Lands.
Any questions for Ms. Saladin? Yes, Mr. Representative Gerard and Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Elise. Do you have any jurisdiction over ONC lands?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, we do not.
Thank you.
Probably thinking thankfully.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Louise, again, I just want to commend you for what you're doing with the in-lieu lands. And as you know, as we've discussed before, I certainly do support that effort and look forward to seeing some revenues produced from those lands. In the budget package here, I see that common school fund distributions are anticipated to be $23.4 million less, and yet the market value, the balance of the fund itself, is increasing. So I guess I'm having a hard time reconciling that. Could you please elaborate?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, we'll bring you some updated information during the next phase of the budget process. We actually think our the distributions are actually going to increase slightly for the 07-09 biennium. And that's when we were putting these numbers together, we did not have an end-of-the-year number for 2006. We now do. The distributions for the first year of the 07-09 biennium are going to be up significantly from what we expected, and we're now projecting that the second year actually will also be up over what the original projection was.
Let's see, Representative Nolan, then Representative Plant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Saladin, I suspect we'll get into this when we go into the detail of the budget, but I notice you've got a couple of fee bills in your legislative package, and yet I also couldn't help but notice that you have a substantial percentage-wise increase in the general fund in the governor's recommended budget. It looks to me like your new fee bill, 2106, relates to the lion's share of that increase in general fund, same program area, so I'm curious whether that fee isn't going into other funds instead of general funds?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, the general fund is for the streamlining package, which is, let me make sure I get the right ones. The general fund that we've requested is for package 112, which is, if you turn that page over, the package is laid out. Okay. So package 112 is the streamlining effort that we are proposing that came out of a budget note that several state agencies got in 2005. Normally, the Department of State Lands doesn't request general fund for its packages. We request common school fund, other fund limitation. In this case, because the streamlining proposal is one in which the Department of State Lands would take on some of the responsibilities that other agencies currently carry out with regard to permitting, that we would request that as general fund. So that's the general fund increase, is that particular package that's related to streamlining of state permits so that other state authorizations that are needed for activities in waters of the state would be done as part of the removal fill permitting activities. And so we would build those into our permit process. We would do the pre-applications. We would bring together all the other agencies. We would provide the information to applicants. We would process the application through all of the state authorizations that are needed and issue those at the back end. The fee bill, House Bill 2106, is related to Package 111, which is to expedite wetland delineations. We are currently in a situation where we have a backlog of wetland delineation reviews and concurrences, and as a result, we are generally only getting to wetland delineation reviews and concurrences after a permit application comes in the door. From our perspective, that's too late in the process. What we really want are permit applications to come in the door after people have had their wetland delineation reviewed and concurred with so that they are designing their projects to avoid, minimize, or mitigate impacts on waters of the state. So two separate efforts.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And as I said, I suspect Ms. Soliday will get into the details on this later. And I support... Generally, I'm a big fan of streamlining projects, but I also believe that they benefit not only the general public, but the permit applicants. And I'd like to see them share in the opportunity to make that happen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, I agree wholeheartedly. The whole idea behind the wetland delineation review and concurrence is that the applicant should be paying the cost of that program, and our overall fee bill, which is House Bill 2105, to raise all of our fees related to removal fill, is to begin to shift the cost back to the applicants where it started back in 1987 or so, and less on the common school fund.
Thank you.
Additional questions?
Yes, one question. The 24,000 acres once you added two pots together. What was the timeline? You mentioned it, but I missed it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, over the next 10 years.
And, Mr. Chair, just wondered if it was, you know, would it be of interest at least to anybody else, maybe just me, what, you know, sort of locations and what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, we can get you the asset management plan, which lays out parcel by parcel where those lands are that are likely to be available for sale over the next 10 years. And this is not new. We've sold lands in the past, and we've just really done a parcel-by-parcel analysis and identified a larger set than we have in the past.
Any additional questions? Hearing no additional questions, we will see you in the foreseeable future.
Weeks.
Is there anything to bring forward for the good of the order?
Hearing nothing,
Chair. Yes.
What are your opening comments on budget and policy? Seems like it's really going to be hard for us just to, I mean, how are we going to resolve that?
I recognize, Senator Nelson, that that is going to be hard. I think it's going to be up to the chair to actually monitor that discussion and basically point out that opportune times when we're getting a little bit astray from a budget issue.
I'd like to know what drives, does policy drive budget or the budget drive policy?
Well, I think it would depend upon who you ask. If you would ask either of the majority leaders, they would tell you that policy. If you would ask either of the co-chairs, they would tell you, well, and I think actually this co-chair probably is more both sides. Yes, if you ask the other co-chair, I think it's primarily budget. He believes drives everything.
We're here to serve, Mr. Chair.
I just don't know what questions to ask. I don't want to give
What I meant by that, actually, is I will give you an example, and I'm not probably giving a great example here. A couple of, I think one or two sessions back, we had a bill that changed the role of the state forester in terms of approving harvesting of land. I was on the losing side of that bill, and I think the number of members here were on the losing side, and some people were on the winning side, and the bill passed. This is not probably the venue to debate that bill again, because it is now state statute. The governor signed it. It is the policy of the state. So that's what I meant as an example.
I would note tomorrow that we have three budgets to go through this review: the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board.
And two of those, the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Environmental Quality, not to slight in any way the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, are the two of the most complex budgets that you will deal with in this process. So we will only have about 25 minutes each for those. So I hope everyone's here at 8:30. We will convene at 8:30, and we will adjourn we will adjourn at 10 a.m. With that, we are adjourned.
I know.